Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. We all yearn for peace, yet the news is full of violence from Afghanistan to Yemen. Is peace possible? Can we stop the seemingly endless wars? Our guest today believes we can have a peaceful world and has dedicated his life to creating it. David Hartzow is Executive Director of Peace Workers based in San Francisco, co-founder of the Nonviolent Peace Force, and an initiator of the World Beyond War movement. He is a Quaker with a BA from Howard University and a Master's in International Relations from Columbia University. Hartzow has been active working locally and internationally for nonviolent social change and peaceful resolution of conflicts since he met Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1956. Hartzow is the author of a powerful memoir, Waging Peace, Global Adventures of a Lifelong Activist, published by PM Press. He's been a friend of mine for many years. Following him will be the head of a new program, Cultivating Leadership Among Working Women. David Hartzow, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you, Eleanor, and to all the listeners, good to be here with you.
Yeah, I'm so excited to have this conversation on the air because I so admire the great work you've done through your whole life. And I'm going to start with maybe the hardest question of all. Is peace possible, and how do we stop the endless wars the U.S. seems to be fighting around the world?
Well, it's obviously a very, very big question, and my belief is that, yes, it is possible. I think, first of all, we need to realize that we're not just a small minority of people that want peace. I think my hunch is that over 90 to 95% of the people of the world want peace. But our governments keep fighting wars.
Mm-hmm.
And President Eisenhower, at the end of his presidency, said, I'd like to believe that the people of the world want peace so much that the governments are going to have to get out of the way and let them have it. Well, I think the time has come when we have endless wars that are not resolving any conflicts. I mean, since 9/11, the United States has spent, I think it's close to $6 trillion, that's T as in trillion, dollars, fighting wars against terrorism. And we now have ever more terrorists to fight. We're creating enemies faster than we can kill them, as one of the former generals said. And so, anyway, so first, we are the mass majority of the world's people. And if we decide, as Eisenhower is suggesting, that we want peace so much, governments are going to have to listen to us. I think, second, wars are not working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if you thought that war was a good idea, it has not resolved anything, certainly in recent years, decades. Third, the Soviet Union bled itself to death in the arms race with the United States. They were trying to keep up with, you know, all it cost to build missiles and bombers and have troops ready to fight a nuclear war. And that was the end of the Soviet Union. Well, we are digging our own grave in this country, and the American people are suffering because we are spending all this money on wars and preparations for wars, for killing and all that. That's to say nothing about the moral question. 180 million people died in wars in the last century. And we're on track to, you know, people continue to get killed by the thousands, hundreds of thousands, even millions. And we are threatening nuclear war with
mm-hmm.
one another. As Dan Ellsberg points out in his new book, and as we know from the danger of nuclear winter as a result of nuclear war, if we have a full-scale nuclear war with Russia or China or any other country, we are going to have nuclear winter. Maybe 2 billion people would die immediately from that war. But within several years, because of nuclear winter, no crops are going to grow, and the world will die of starvation. So the question we have to ask ourselves is anything worth putting an end to human life on our planet? And my answer, I think most people, is no. We cannot endanger the lives of not only our children and their children and their children, but all future generations. So what can we do? Certainly, the rationale for war does not make sense. And if we are awake as American people, as people of the world, we can try to respond to that question. So what we can do is, one, educate ourselves, educate people in our communities and our churches and our synagogues, etc., about the reality of what war is doing, not only to the people that are underneath the bombs, but as Martin Luther King said, what's happening to our soul? And when we are, when we as a country are, I mean, we're dropping bombs on seven Muslim countries right now. And even if we don't think about what's happening to the children and the families and the human beings that are underneath those bombs, we have to think about what's happening to our souls, that we as a country, as a people, are willing to do this to other human beings. As Eleanor mentioned, I co-founded World Beyond War, and that is an organization of people that have, I mean, we have folks in, I think, 180 countries or so that are working to try to achieve that goal, to end the institution of war. And if you go to that website, worldbeyondwar.org, you'll see lots of resources and suggestions for what you can do. But one of the things we have there is what we call a $2 trillion question. And that's what the world spends every year on wars and preparations for wars. $2 trillion. Half of that is being spent by the United States, as much as the rest of the world all put together. And what we do in that 10-minute video is look at what we are getting with that $2 trillion by the wars that we're fighting. And then we look at what could we do alternatively with that $2 trillion. And we could put an end to hunger, not only in this country, but all around the world. We could have decent health care for every person in the world. We could have a decent education. We could have free college education for every person in this country. We could end homelessness. We could probably, if we were to take even a small portion of that $1 trillion that the United States spends on wars and preparations for wars, to create a better life for every person on the planet, we could be, I think, the most secure nation in the world. And there are alternatives to war. And World Beyond War has put out a book called A Global Security System and Alternatives to War, which is available from Amazon or from World Beyond War, or hopefully get your bookstore to get it. But in that, we look at what an alternative global security system would look like. And it's looking at security for the whole world, not just for the United States. So it's negotiation, it's mediation, it's trying to look at what are the needs of people and of countries on both sides of a conflict, and then resolving that at the negotiation table rather than who has the more bombs that can kill more people on the other side. And
right. Well, you know,
along with that Eisenhower quote that I mentioned, that governments will have to get out of the way and let the people have peace, people all over the world have discovered the power of nonviolent action and of building nonviolent movements. and dictatorships have been overthrown by nonviolent movements. So people all over the world are discovering the power of nonviolent action and are using that understanding to build movements to challenge the governments that are not listening to the people. And most recently, the South Korean, in South Korea, they had a president who was really itching for war with North Korea. And she was the daughter of the worst dictator that Korea ever had, South Korea. And millions of people throughout the winter were out in the streets every day demanding that that she resign her position. And she was also corrupt. The people were successful in getting her thrown out of office. She's now in jail. And through a popular movement, they elected a president who was committed to making peace with North Korea. And in this last year, we've seen more progress toward peace between North and South Korea than we'd had in 70 years. So yeah, that's an example.
Yeah.
We don't have to just go along with what our government says is truth, what our government says is the only way of resolving conflicts or of achieving security. And if we understand that what we're doing is not working and it's getting us further and further in the rat hole of bleeding ourselves to death and seeing our kids suffer because they don't have decent schools, seeing that we don't have the money to make the transformation to a renewable energy future rather than go down the path of global warming, et cetera. We need to also build a movement of movements. At the moment, folks are working on all these different issues. There's the environmental movement. There's the movement addressing poverty, addressing racism, addressing, you know, the migrant crisis, et cetera. And we need to realize that we're all in the same struggle, and we need to be working together rather than separately. And if we begin to work together, we're going to have a lot more power. And I think that one of the hopeful things on the horizon, or that's happening right now, is the Poor People's Campaign.
All right, we'll get to that in a minute. But before you go there, I just want to say you made a very powerful case for why war does not make sense and that we actually have some practical alternatives to it, and you've laid them all out with your group there, World Beyond War, in the book about the global security system. And I think at this age where we've got nuclear weapons and various weapons of mass destruction and terrorism, that truly none of us is secure unless all of us is secure. And
right.
You've laid out there how we can do that. You mentioned in talking about Dr. Martin Luther King and asking, you know, what happens to our soul when we're executing all these wars. You met Dr. King in 1956. Tell us about your connection with him and how it has shaped your life.
Well, thank you for that question. This was during the Montgomery bus boycott in Alabama, in Montgomery, Alabama, where they'd had segregation. First, they'd had slavery throughout the South, and then they had it was replaced by segregation and Jim Crow. And so in Montgomery, Alabama, the Negroes, as they called themselves at that time, or the African Americans, had to ride at the back of the bus. And they could go in the front and pay their money and then go back out and go in the back door and sit back there. Well, Rosa Parks decided that she could no longer, she was actually in the middle of the bus because the whole back was filled up. And a white man came and said, get up. I want to sit down. And she decided she'd had enough of that and stayed sitting. And the bus driver had her arrested. And that was the beginning of the Montgomery bus boycott, where essentially 100% of the African-American people in Montgomery decided to boycott the buses. They would not ride the buses. They would walk to work, getting up even an hour or so early in the morning, rather than ride the buses. So I was down there in, over our spring break in 1956 and met Martin Luther King and Ralph Abernathy and the other leaders of that movement. And it was so inspiring to me to see people en masse engaging in nonviolent action. And even when some of the black churches were bombed, instead of saying, we're going to go and bomb the white churches, they said, we're going to love our enemy. And we're not going to give in to this fear and the terror, but we're going to just continue our bus boycott. So anyway, that was very inspiring for me. So inspiring that I decided to go to Howard University in Washington, D.C. In the fall of 1959 because I heard that Howard was interested in getting white students to integrate it. And I had spent 1 year at Swarthmore, a white college, trying to get blacks accepted there. And I thought, maybe I should just, you know, practice what I preach and go and help integrate Howard the other way around. Well, so I happened to be at Howard in the spring of 60 when four African-American students from Greensboro, North Carolina, went to a lunch counter to get something to eat. And instead of getting something to eat, they were arrested. And that was a spark that African-American students all over the South began going to drugstores, to Woolworths, et cetera, in their own communities to challenge segregation. And so at Howard, we began going to Maryland and Virginia, which were still totally segregated at that time. And I actually spent most of my weekends in jail with other students from Howard University in Maryland. And we didn't go to Virginia because Virginia had passed a law saying anybody that challenged segregation there would get a year in prison, or 6 months in prison, excuse me, and a $500 fine. And we preferred to spend a weekend in jail. But by June of 1960, still nobody had challenged that law in Virginia. And we did some additional nonviolence training and went across the river to Arlington to a people's drugstore, a so-called people's drugstore, sat down, and instead of getting something to eat, the owner didn't want the publicity, so he didn't arrest us, but he also wasn't going to give us anything to eat. So we sat there for 2 days waiting for something to eat or drink, and it was the most challenging 2 days of my life. The American Nazi Party came with their swastikas. People spat at us in the face. They put lit cigarettes down our shirts in our backs. They would punch us in the stomach. And each time something like this would happen, we would try to respond in a spirit of love and nonviolence, as students across the South were committed to do. And toward the end of the second day, I heard a guy come up to me and it says, if you don't get out of this store in 2 seconds, I'm going to stab this through your heart. And his hand was a switchblade. And I had 2 seconds to decide, how do I really respond to this fellow? And we'd had a lot of practice, and I just looked at him, and I said, friend, do what you believe is right, but I'll still try to love you. And it was quite amazing, his jaw that was, you know, his face contorted with hatred and his switchblade in his hand began to fall, and he left the store.
That's amazing.
And so that was quite a life-changing in terms of, wow, the power of nonviolence to try to communicate with a person so full of hatred. But then we wrote a statement appealing to the religious and community leaders of Arlington to use their influence to get the eating facilities open to everyone. And we luckily got a ride back to Washington, and we had said, if nothing changes in a week, we'll be back. And we literally shook back at Howard for 6 days whether we had the courage to go back. And on the sixth day, we got a phone call that the religious and community leaders of Arlington had met, had talked with the business leaders, and got a commitment to open the eating facilities within 10 days.
Wow, that's impressive.
It's the most important lesson of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Something terrible is happening. You don't just have to curse the television set or war or segregation. You find some other people that believe as deeply as you do about something, get some nonviolent training, and go and challenge it. And if you do that nonviolently and lovingly and on a sustained basis, meaning weeks, months, maybe even years, we can win. And we've got to address the questions confronting us today of segregation, of the immigration crisis, of war, of racism, with that same kind of determination. And so each of us in our own church, in our own community, in our circle of friends, need to find people that share our concerns as deeply as we do, and educate ourselves about that issue, and begin organizing and educating, and taking nonviolent direct action, as happened in the women's suffrage movement, as happened in the freedom movement in the 60s, it happened in the anti-Vietnam War movement, it's happened in the gay and lesbian community movement, et cetera.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, we certainly do have challenges of today. We've mostly got the integration issue moved ahead, but there are certainly major challenges today with the continuing wars, as you mentioned, the immigration, and also what's coming back with a vengeance now, the voter suppression, particularly against African Americans and low-income people or people who are likely to be Democrats. So our listeners tend to be a very informed and active group. You've just laid out kind of a pathway for how to take action against those things that we're concerned about, find people who share our concerns, take nonviolence training. Where can listeners get that nonviolence training now?
Well, you can go to, there's a group called Alternatives to Violence. You can find that on the web. You can go to Training for Change, which is offering trainings. The War Resistance League is offering trainings. There's a group in Washington, D.C. called Nonviolence International. Any of these groups will steer you to where you can get trainings. Here in the in Northern California, we have something called the East Point Peace Academy. That's the alternative to the West Point Military Academy. But they give trainings in Kingian nonviolence. So there's many opportunities. There's something called Campaign Nonviolence that's really trying to address climate change and militarism and poverty and injustice with groups all across the country that are also offering trainings.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I love that. And by the way, I think you were one of the people who trained me in nonviolence many years ago when we were protesting both nuclear weapons and the wars in Central America. So thank you for that and for continuing your great work. We have just a couple of minutes left. I was hoping you could give us a very brief report on the new Poor People's Campaign, because we're in a situation now where instead of strengthening the middle class, we've now have more and more people have dropped out of the middle class and into poverty. We have half our people in the United States are unable to meet any kind of emergency expense and sometimes hard to meet their basic expenses, choosing between paying rent or buying food. what's happening with the new Poor People's Campaign?
Well, I was a part of the first Poor People's Campaign 50 years ago. It was Martin Luther King's last vision and last campaign. And the goal is to, partly we're saying poverty and hunger and lack of decent education and lack of health care in the richest nation in the world is not acceptable, especially when there's more and more billionaires, which are becoming richer by the moment. So the Poor People's Campaign is addressing the three evils that Martin Luther King talked about, racism, militarism, and poverty or injustice. And are adding to that the whole climate justice question. And so it's bringing together people that are working on all these issues into a common campaign. Last spring, in 42 states, for 6 weeks, every Monday, people from all these campaigns, unions, religious community, environmentalists, et cetera, came together in the state capitals to petition to their legislatures and to their governors, here are our demands. And if they were not received or they did not accept these, there were people that were many people, hundreds of people, that were willing to risk arrest and were arrested. And then in June, people from all over the country came to Washington, D.C., and again we took our demands to Congress, and hundreds of us were arrested as we tried to take those demands to our members of Congress. In the south of this country, a major issue right now is the voter disenfranchisement and the gerrymandering. And really, as we saw in the last several elections, this last election in Georgia and Florida and Alabama, et cetera, a few votes would have made the difference. And essentially, these votes were stolen. So people are developing voter registration, obviously, is another thing that people are working on. But so people are working on these issues at a grassroots level and trying to build nonviolent people power. It's the same way as the Korean people did, to say, if our representatives in government will not listen to us, we're going to replace you.
Right, and we saw some of that happening in the recent midterm elections, where some of the people who were blocking progress and not listening were knocked out by others who ran to challenge them and won.
That's right. That's right. And I think I'd like to just share one more story.
We have like 30 seconds left.
Okay.
Go ahead. Hit the highlights.
I think the sense of hopelessness and despair that people are faced with, we need to face that head on. And people underneath the bombs in Yemen, in Iraq and Syria, et cetera, are facing much, much worse than we are. We need to find our courage. We need to go out and find people that in our own communities that we can work with and begin to work for and demand this kind of fundamental change that has to happen in this country if we're to have a future.
Absolutely right. And I wish we had more time, and I encourage our listeners to read your book, Waging Peace, Global Adventures of a Lifelong Activist, available from PM Press or from Amazon or your local bookstore. These tales are amazing. We didn't even get to your visit with President John F. Kennedy in the White House. So listeners, please read this book and you will be inspired. That's all the time we have. David Hartzell, thank you so much for being with us today and for the principles bold way you have lived your life with courage and love.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.